Good morning. I think I'll be looking at sub-Saharan Africa, looking at domestic violence in Zimbabwe. It is a work in progress. You will have realized from the program that we're going to look into Malawi and Zambia. We are going to do that, and we are doing that. I would like to thank my other co-authors, Monica and Sean Curtis. Monica she's doing another presentation today, so she gave me the responsibility to present this. I think it's also a gender balance that males, who are usually the perpetrators of domestic violence, should be standing up here and talking about it. I'll just give a contextual background, in the sense that it's also the reason why we focus on Zimbabwe. I'm from Zimbabwe myself. I was born and brought up in Zimbabwe. Also, the reason why we're focusing on Malawi, I'm from Malawi also. The reason why we are focusing on Zambia, I won't say that I'm from Zambia, but I've worked in Zambia. But we are going to look into the Zimbabwean domestic violence issue. When we're looking at domestic violence in Zimbabwe, really, it is a deeply rooted social-cultural explanation linked to social structure of patriarchy. I think when you look at sub-Saharan Africa, is that structure of our social, of patriarchy really is more prevalent. There are very few countries which women make more decision, or we have models like women being in power. For example, the tribe which my mom comes from in Malawi is more women dominated. She makes the decision. Where I was brought up at my mom's village instead of my father's village. My father shifted his household into my mother's village. I think through that aspect of it, maybe she instilled in me the issue of standing up and focusing on gender violence. If I was on the other side, I don't know where I will be now, but I think I'll be where I am now. This is the structure which is there in Zimbabwe. And also within Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe got independence in 1980. It was a British colony. There were several changes which happened really when it comes to education, employment, where women saw themselves moving up in their social structure and or social status. That to some extent is causing conflict between males and females. There has been also a history of colonialism and white minority rule. We are not saying that they brought in gender, but they codified gender inequalities in Zimbabwe. They made it into a law. Let's say, for example, pre-independence, women were not allowed to have their own bank account. You could not take a loan. You know, all those things, they brought it into law, I think also perpetuated gender inequalities, which has had an implication on domestic violence in Zimbabwe. The political transition was quite also important in the Zimbabwean context, that during the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe, males and females fought at equal footing, really. But after independence, the males wanted to dominate, whilst the women also contributed significantly during the liberation struggle. And most of the women were against such an issue that if you treated us equally during the war, we should be treated equally post-war. And there was an issue of economic crisis and adjustment. You realize that Zimbabwe currently also now is facing an economic crisis, and also the World Bank, IMF, really brought in what they call economic structural adjustment programs, where most of the males lost their jobs and women retained their jobs. That also, to some extent, caused inequalities within households and was really a recipe, can I say, for disaster for women in such relationships. When you're looking at the background also, most of our studies on domestic violence have been done within the U.S. Very limited studies have been done in sub-Saharan Africa. Most of the studies have been focused, when I look in sub-Saharan Africa, in South Africa, Tanzania, Kenya, Egypt. However, when you're looking at Zimbabwe, no study has been done exploring the nature of domestic violence using a national representative sample. The statistics from the High Court of Zimbabwe, you realize what I say there. By 1994, 65% of murder cases in the Harare High Court, which is the capital city of Zimbabwe, were due to domestic violence. You could see that there is a higher murder case really, but nothing has been done to do studies on what is causing domestic violence in Zimbabwe. Thus, this study contributes to the foundation of quantitative research in Zimbabwe on this topic of domestic violence and the nature of domestic violence in Zimbabwe, and also contributing to the growth of literature in Africa. The data which I'm using for this study, which we use for this study, is the Zimbabwean Demographic Health Survey, the most recent survey, the 2005 and 2006 survey, and it's also a first national representative domestic violence sample. There were three subsequent ZDHSs which were done, or the Zimbabwe Demographic Health Surveys which were done, but none of them collected any issues related to domestic violence. And this tool which was used was a revised conflict statistics scale. The way the sample was done, really, it was a national domestic violence sample. One eligible woman, ages 15 to 49, was selected per household using what they call the CRISH grid. So in that aspect, the sample which you are seeing there of 3,694 is the final analytical sample, but 8,970 women were eligible for were included in the survey, or were sampled and interviewed. From that, 6,293 ever married women were asked questions on domestic violence, but this study is only limited to currently married women, and also those women who answered questions on household decision making. So it was also another selected sample. The method which we use at SCAL, we use univariate and multi-level logistic regression, trying to find out whether individual level determinants, what are the roles of individual level determinants and also contextual level determinants. The research objective, really primarily, there are three. First one, we estimated the prevalence of current physical and sexual violence within the last 12 months prior to the survey, and also try to identify individual level characteristics associated with violence and relational and contextual factors associated with violence. Well, like I've said, our outcome variables was physical and sexual violence in the last 12 months. When we look at the individual level variables, we are looking at women's characteristics, the social demographic characteristics of age, education, a history of family violence, whether the woman was abused when she was by the age of 15 onwards, whether she was abused by a family member. Also, we brought in the husband characteristics. Primarily, those were derived from the woman. They were asked the age of the husband, the education, and the occupation. We also included within the individual level variables what we call relational variables. This has to do with household decision making. We constructed a scale called the Male Patriarchal Control Index, and then we looked at the age differences, education differences, and occupational differences between spouses, whether those have a role or influence on domestic violence. When it comes to the level two contextual level variables, we looked at community education, where community wife beating norms, community wealth index, and also looked at place of residency as one of the contextual variables. Turning on into the results, I'm going to give you the prevalence rates for domestic violence, lifetime and current domestic violence, but subsequently the analysis will be focused on current domestic violence when we're looking at the determinants. At least 28% of women reported that they had experienced lifetime domestic violence, one physical act of domestic violence. When we're looking at current domestic violence, it was 24%. When we're looking at sexual violence, 13% of women say they at least experienced one sexual act of sexual violence ever in their lifetime, and 12% within the last 12 months. And when you're looking at whether they experience both, or either, sorry, physical or sexual violence, is 19% or 20% for lifetime domestic violence, and 15% for current domestic violence. To some extent, really, this is comparable to some of the levels which have been found, or magnitude which have been found in sub-Saharan Africa, in South Africa, in Tanzania and Kenya. But in Zimbabwe, we cannot say this is a tolerable level. It is quite high. It is quite high. what we did also is to look at the specific acts of physical violence. For both lifetime and recent physical violence, slapping, punching, kicking, or beating up were the most commonly reported acts of physical abuse. I think you can see when you say slapped, it's 21% and 24%. I think this is what also the gentleman from Mexico said, talked about, that they don't consider this as part of domestic violence when you ask males. But when you're looking, when you're reporting, when the women report, this is really the most common act of violence. Equally so, for both lifetime and recent physical violence, threatened or attacked is the least common type of physical abuse. I think you will see that it's about 2% or 4% of the women reported that. There is an equal reporting when it comes to sexual violence. The reason why that is so, and it's also, it looks as if it's really small proportion, is how sexual violence is perceived within our communities. Rape is not considered as a sexual violence within a marital union. I think if you force yourself on a woman, they won't report it as a rape. I think this is one of the things also they've been socialized, that sexual intercourse is really a right for a man, no matter how it is done. Really, that's the reason why you may find that there are low reporting on those two acts. Now I'll turn on to the determinants of physical violence. I'll be looking at this. Among the nine women's social demographic variables, only six women's characteristics were significantly associated with physical violence experienced in the prior year. What I've done there is only list those factors which are significant, really related to physical violence. Age really is a protective factor. But when you're looking at the number of children, the more kids the woman had, the more likely she was to experience domestic violence. I think you're looking at, in the case of Zimbabwe, really, anecdotally, I know the first, when you get married, you're young, you're in love, and everything looks nice. You know, as you get older, most of Zimbabwean women tend to have extramarital activities. So the more as you get older, you have more kids. And then they feel like, oh, now she's boring. I need to go and get another one. I think to get away from here or to support that extramarital activity, they tend to be more abusive to their partners. The history, also what we found in this study, that women who came from families which had a history of domestic violence were 59% more likely to experience violence. The same applies also to those women who had been abused during childhood, were 63% more likely to be abused by their partners. When we looked at the three variables or characteristics of males, only occupation was significantly related to domestic violence. This doesn't come as a surprise to me, in the sense that especially you'll find that agriculture, those men who were employed in agriculture were more abusive, or those women who says their husbands were employed in agriculture had experienced more abuse. It happens in Zimbabwe mainly anecdotally, through newspaper reads, really, which you are reading, during the harvesting season. Most males, when women are the ones who do most of the labor, tilling of the land, everything else, they harvest, the guys are the ones who take the products to the market. When they do that, instead of bringing the money back home, they go drinking beer. They don't come home, squander all the money out there. When they come home, the woman will ask, where is the money? The guys become abusive. That was the trend in Zimbabwe. I think when I was looking at the DHS now, the results, I'm saying, oh, this is being reflected in this data set. But when I was growing up and when I was reading through it, especially during the cotton season and tobacco season, when it's harvesting of that, those males whose wives were involved in agriculture were more abusive. When we look at relational factors, we realize also women's status, where if males have more decision-making power within the households, women were 20% more likely to be abused in comparison to those who had joint decision-making within the household. The male patriarchal control index, the way it was measured, we were looking at different aspects. There were about six items which were considered. For example, women were asked whether their husband were jealous or angry if she talks to another man, if she frequently accuses her of being faithful, it does not permit her to meet friends. So we brought in all those items and created an index. And we realized those men who were more prone to be controlling over their wives, those women experienced were 56% more likely to be in an abusive relationship or to have been abused in the last year. The other variables of age difference, education difference, really, the occupational difference, they were not significant, but spousal age difference, especially if they were 10 years or more older than their wife, they were less likely to have been abused. I think it's also some of the things which have been found within the literature. The wife beating norms, it's one factor which we found to be significantly associated with abuse, that women who felt that it is okay to be beaten if you burn your food, you don't take care of your child and everything else, those women were likely to be abused if they held such types of views. I think it's something which shows which they are socialized to do in our culture, really. When you're growing up, when you're seeing your parents being beaten up, you feel as if it's part of the norm within the household. If my mom didn't take care of me and my father beat him up, I feel it's like that's supposed to be the case, how I'm supposed to treat women, but it's not supposed to be the case. Now I'm going to turn into the page of sexual violence. I was looking at physical violence. The reason why I looked in these two differently, in the sense that they don't share the same determinants in certain instances. So I felt that I should just come up with that picture. And also, what's quite interesting and also revealing here, women who were involved in an occupation were more likely to be abused across all, almost all types of occupation, be it services, agriculture, and also in manual work. They were more likely to be abused. When it comes to ethnicity, it had no influence or role when it comes to physical violence, but in sexual violence, those women who came from the Ndebele tribe in Zimbabwe, which is on this 20% of the population in Zimbabwe is Ndebele, which is resident on the southern part of Zimbabwe, they were less likely to be abused. I, by default, where I was born in the Ndebele side. So I might say we are less abusive to women, but something else really, which is revealing here. And the interesting aspect of it, when you are looking at the DHS, it doesn't collect information on ethnicity in Zimbabwe. So this was a proxy variable where we looked at the language of interview, and we realized and we cross-tabbed the language of interview per the provinces or the region. We realized it was really 90% of those persons who spoke Ndebele were in the southern part of it, showing that most of the persons who were interviewed in Ndebele were actually in Ndebele within the regions where they stay. The Shona tribe is also totally different from the Ndebele tribe in the way their culture, the way it's structured and everything else. Equally important, those women who came from a family with a history of violence were 41% more likely to have experienced sexual violence within the last 12 months. Household decision, it was marginally significant, but what's quite important, what is also being revealed between for both physical and sexual violence, is the male patriarchal control index, that those women who reported that their husband had more control over them, what they were supposed to have been done, they were more likely to experience physical or sexual violence. The same applies also of wife beating norms. if they held high wife-beating norms, they were more likely to do that. You can see within that, within these results, really, issue of gender inequalities and also the issue of patriarchy is being revealed quite more evident or substantively. When we looked at the contextual variables also, something which came as a surprise, those women who say they came from clusters or communities with high education, when it comes to more women at more high education within that cluster, within that community, they were more likely to experience domestic violence. It's something which it's a little bit puzzling, really. I'm trying to figure out why is it so that when they come to they come from such communities, you'll expect them to have low experience of domestic violence. But in this case, that's not the issue. They were 73% more likely to experience domestic violence. But however, if they came from communities with high wealth, they were 50% less likely to experience domestic violence. In summary, we realized that there's a high prevalence of domestic violence in Zimbabwe. The prevalence for physical violence is 24%, for sexual violence is 12% among married women in Zimbabwe. And when we looked at the determinants of physical violence, having a history of family violence, experiencing violence during childhood, and also men having the final decision making in domestic issues, and male patriarchal control, and occupation status, specifically if males or husbands were involved in agricultural occupation, those were risk factors for physical violence within the last 12 months. The same applies with wife-beating norms, that if women had high wife-beating norms, they were more likely to experience that. There were studies which were done in Zimbabwe in 2003 by Hiding from the Johns Hopkins University, that they were quite surprised that most women in Zimbabwe, also about 53% of them, they were saying it's okay being beaten by your husband. I think this is reflected also here, that they feel it's okay, therefore, when they are beaten, I think the issue of reporting will be quite low also to the relevant authorities. When we look at sexual violence, occupation, ethnicity, let's say, for example, occupation, occupation, a history of family violence, the husband having the final decision-making, and male patriarchal control were risk factors. Ethnicity was a protective factor, same as applies with community wealth, but wife-beating norms and community education were risk factors. Generally, I think I placed that statement deliberately there to show how most women are brought up in our context when it comes to acceptance of violence, that women are socialized to accept violence within marriage. I think this is what I was talking about, the study which was done in 2000, that is an inevitable part of marriage. We have saying in our vernacular language in Zimbabwe, the first saying which is in quotes is in Shona, which says, "Ndizo zvinoita zvimba," or Ndebele, which is my language, "Vegezela umenda utunyelwa gundwani." You know, it means the first one says, this is what happens in a marriage, you know. If they beat you, you have to go back. This is how I survived as your mother in this marriage. So you have to take care of your husband. Everything is going to be okay. The second part of it, the Ndebele said, "Vegezela umenda utunyelwa gundwani," and this means that you have to be patient in your marriage. If only we had known, or if only you wanted to know what type of a husband your husband was going to be, let's put it that way, if it's good English in that way, we're going to send a mouse or a rat to go and spy. You know, that he comes from a violent family, therefore don't go there. But you cannot tell a rat to go and spy because you cannot command it to do that. So you better, can I say, suck it in and stick it out. To some extent, this is what they are told. Yes, there is that high acceptance of domestic violence within marriages in Zimbabwe. In 2007, Zimbabwe, for the first time, really, quite surprisingly, we got independence in 1980. It's more or less like 27 years later, isn't it? We came up with the Zimbabwe Domestic Violence Act. That way, it's really a shame for our country to do that, having that it has had experienced high domestic violence. Not only that, I did a study linking HIV/AIDS infection and domestic violence. Most women who were HIV/AIDS positive who had experienced domestic violence. So it was really one of the issues. We don't know how they are rolling it out, the domestic acts. In most cases in Zimbabwe, I've seen those are acts which are just statutory instruments, but how they translate to programs really in the field is something quite different, given also that there is a strong patriarchal societal structure. How that is going to be tackled really is another issue which is happening, and also given what's happening in Zimbabwe now of the economic crisis and the political crisis, will this be a priority within the nation? I think that's one thing which we have to look into. What is quite positive, there have been some programs in Zimbabwe, education programs for males, when it looks at domestic violence, and they've been creating forums for men to question and reject gender stereotypes. The program is called Padare or Enkundleni. Padare means underneath a tree. I think you've seen that we discuss our problems in the villages in it underneath a tree. So it's a court which is supposed to be done. So that is what epitomizes these main forums in Zimbabwe. Thank you very much. I think I'm done with this. And there are certain things which I had put at the end, how we measured the male patriarchal control index. I think it had an alpha coefficient of 0.72, and also the household domestic decision-making variable, how we measured it, and also community wife-beating norms. It had also a coefficient of 0.82. So this is what my presentation was all about. Accounting for the clustering, I think when it comes initially, what I did, I looked at the when I did the logistic, I did simple logistic regression. Really, it becomes easier accounting for the sampling design. Are you looking at the sampling design or the clustering aspect of it? Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. I think that's the reason why I use the multi-level. If you use a multi-level analysis, it accounts for that clustering. It is a multi-level which I use. I use a multi-level analysis. That's what I use. Use Stata for that, and also using HLM. You can use HLM or MLWIN. This is what it accounted for that. Yes, it did. Initially, what I did, you can use it. Use the fixed effects. The fixed effects, you are not read controlling from the random effects, but I use the random effects again to check whether there is intra-cluster correlation, and I found that it was really quite high, and showing that within there is a variance within those clusters really. So I think you use it that way, yeah. Especially if you want to, you are going to come up with composite aggregate level type of variables, like community wealth index, community education. That invariable led me to use multi-level analysis. I think this is what I stated in my methodology, that I use univariate and multi-level logistic regression. I did that.
Multi-level approach when sometimes people, when you're clustering, you have like a I think if the cluster level is so small, I think there is a study which was done by Gage or something on those lines where they realized the cluster sample is quite small. I think it was domestic violence in Ecuador. I think I cannot remember what they did, but they went to the next level, maybe the district level. You know, depending how it is structured when it comes to stratification, how it was stratified. I can give you the reference at the end of this. I think they did that. I never had any problems of the number of persons within each cluster. Yes, I had no problem of that. There were insufficient number of respondents within each cluster. I looked into that. I sent out my variables.
I think it's dependent on what you want to achieve as an individual, really. I think when I used the aspect of it, when I used Stata, Stata doesn't give you that option. But when you're using HLM, I mean, I'm not that used to Stata, but if when you use HLM, you have that option of it, grade centered mean or not. I think it depends, really. I just simply did an aggregation at the cluster level. That's what I did. But I think those are the things which I'm going to look into and revisit. What are the differences when it comes to the outcomes, really, the coefficients in the standard areas if I don't do a grand mean, whatever you call this. If I don't do it that way, what are the differences in my standard errors and my coefficients? If there's no difference, sometimes it's just becoming more refined in your methodology. That would be the case. HLM gives you that option, and also MLWIN gives you that option. But now, for expedience here, I used Stata. Go ahead, ma'am. Can I go back to how do I go? Okay, just hold on. No, don't worry, ma'am. Okay, you mean this one?
Yeah, because, yeah. So there are a few different, items, and it seems like even a few items, but when you're presenting it in the model, so it's a category for variables, so I was wondering how
I came up with the category variable? Okay. Those are the things they're looking at women's own health. They were asking whether the person who made that decision was the wife, the husband, both, or someone else, isn't it? So if someone said, if it is my own health, it is me, that woman has categorized, I said wife dominant, women make most of the decisions.
So she has to say yes on all of them, or just at least one of them?
At least one of them.
At least one.
Yeah. At least one of them. What I can do, I can share with you the paper, the draft paper. I have the draft paper with me here, so I can share it with you.
Any more questions?
Okay. Okay. When you're looking at that, isn't it? They were looking at wife, husband, both, or someone else. If it's wife dominant, really, make most of the decision, are they making most of the decision in all those five or six items? So they were saying, yes, wife, so you classify them as that. If it's wife, if it's husband dominant, you do it. If it's other, so it's based on the frequency distribution and also what's happening within those items. What I can do, I can, after this, sit down with you and tell you how I did that. It should have at least one. In one, I think when it says wife dominant, make most of the decisions, is at least one of those, the woman did a decision making. Yeah, it is at least one. If you say most all of them, you have a very small frequency. You have a bit. I think let's discuss about it. I think I have it all done. Then I'll.
Thank you very much.
She was. She had given me time, 2 minutes, 1 minute, 0 minutes, so I was a little bit rushed in that, so I discussed.
Thank you very much to all of our panelists. These were wonderful examples of intimate partner violence, some of the causes of it, how it really transcends culture, ethnicity, geography. We saw examples of the correlation between childhood abuse and intimate partner violence in Ecuadorian women. We saw examples of a successful culturally appropriate intervention for Latino migrant communities and some of the determinants of violence in Zimbabwe. I'd like to open it up to questions for all of our panelists. Doesn't have to be a question. Any thoughts or ideas? We have some time for discussion. And I'd like to thank all of our panelists once again. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Sorry about the time, but
okay. No, I never thought that I'd gone through.
That was very interesting.
Can I just talk to you quick?
She did talk from there.
I'm not sure. What is sexual IPV?
Like,